Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The T20 World Cup is coming to our shores in 2020 with the best of the best striving for the ultimate glory. Before that all kicks off, let's join Mel Jones as she chats to cricket royalty on road to the T20 World Cup.
In 2017, England handled the expectations of winning a home 50-over World Cup in front of a packed-out Lords. Today on Road to the T20 World Cup, we catch up with the coach of the Australian women's cricket team, Matthew Mott, and chat all things pressure and expectations, honesty sessions, leadership, and what speeds fast bowlers can reach.
Most importantly, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
2020, can you
New
believe
decade.
It? I know.
Yeah.
How would you describe your last decade?
Busy, fulfilling. Yeah, big family time. Yeah. Obviously, two kids in that decade. So, well, one in the decade before, actually. Jai's just before that. But, yeah, Miller come in. She's changed the world up a little bit.
She's got a bit of spunk about her.
Yeah, she has. She's full of energy, 24-7. So, when she goes down, we all get to have a rest. Other than that, not too much.
Could you see her playing cricket for Australia?
I could see her being passionate about something. I don't know whether it's cricket. But she has sat down a couple of times and said, I want to watch the cricket with you, Daddy. So, that's already... More than probably Jai's ever sat down to watch. Jai's more of a doer.
But
I think Miller's first taste of cricket she loves. I mean, she's getting a bit spoiled at the moment in and around this Australian team. So, yeah, I think she doesn't realise how good she's got it.
Yeah, and for those that don't know, we're sitting in the Intercontinental Hotel in Double Bay. It's New Year's Day. Sydney Test is about to start, a couple of days away with the Australian men's team. And, of course, you're getting prepared for all things World Cup as well. I want to go back before we get to the current state of play. I interviewed Charlotte Edwards recently and I said, are you the most famous person coming out of her town in England? And she said, of course she was. Can I say the same about you for Charleville, Queensland? It was almost 700 kilometres from Brizzy. It's in the middle of nowhere. Can you say that?
Yeah, I think you can. Yeah. Mum and Dad, both school teachers, and my dad got posted out there. So I was born there, only lived there for 2 years, unfortunately, and it hurts me to say this, I have not been back yet.
Are you kidding me?
It's on my bucket list to do. And something Jai, my son, is very big on is getting back out there. So it's quite funny how, because it just stands out, doesn't it? You don't really hear of Charleville.
No.
Some great stories about growing up and, you know, bore water in the streets and, you know, very dry place, you know, red dust everywhere. So I really do want to get back there and have a look around.
Love it. It's funny when you're getting prepped for interviews and you go through the usual, as we have coffees arriving, which is probably needed. You look at it all, and there's the first thing that comes up is your Wikipedia page, and your photo is Trent Woodhill.
Yeah.
Do you know that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, my brother-in-law picked that up on that one day and sent it to me, and because he knows Trent Woodhill from down in the Shire, and he's like, have you tried to change this? And I haven't ever bothered to change it, but yeah, I don't think we look that similar either. But we're both in blues kit, and that's close enough, I guess.
If you had a photo, what would you change it to? Is there a photo that stands out for you?
No, not really. I yet to find a photo that's done me justice, Mel, to be honest.
Okay. There's a challenge for 2020.
I always look at them and go, surely I'm looking better than that. But yeah, it's an interesting one. I do notice over the years, though, there's a lot less hair on the head than there probably was. So probably something in my mid-20s I'd try and hang on to, maybe in my days down in Victoria. It's been a while between good photos.
I'll find you one and we'll pop it up for the podcast preview.
Thanks.
I do ask everyone, what is their most vivid, enjoyable, passionate sporting memory during their life? It could be playing cricket, completely different sport.
Yeah, I think possibly there's one recent one and one long-term one from watching sport.
Yeah.
Definitely the first AFL grand final that the Lions won. Obviously, I grew up supporting them at the Bears, because they used to play our cricket oval at Carrara. So I always liked them, and when they were getting flogged, it was hard to love them. And then they finally had some success, and that first final, I jagged a ticket late.
It
was one of the great days. I was with my sister's boyfriend, who was an Essendon supporter, and just by the end of the afternoon, it was just a fantastic day. And just the whole vibe of grand final, I don't think anything can really compete with that. Just two teams, and it's such a big day, and they might never play in it again. Yeah. And I think that the whole aura around the MCG,
yeah,
pretty special. But I recently got jagged a ticket, and Meg Lanning went as well, to the President's Cup. And I'm a mad golfer, and I love my golf. And to see that many good golfers in one venue at one time, followed Tiger around for a little while, probably took it for granted years ago, 20-odd years ago, he was in Melbourne, and you thought, oh, we'll just keep seeing you over and over again. And
how things can change.
Yeah, and his life certainly changed a lot. But, you know, as a golf nut, that was pretty special. And I'm a huge fan of the Ryder Cup as well. So any time that's on, I'm pretty locked in.
Did you play golf as a kid?
I did. I wasn't much of a golfer. I probably, the older I've got more into it. And sort of when I made it, decision to sort of, we live in Brisbane, so my first love is surfing in the beach,
yeah,
and that's pretty unreasonable to, you know, jump in the car for an hour and 20 minutes to get to the beach. So golf probably taken over a lot in the last 5 or 6 years, but equally passionate about both.
Okay. So when you were a kid, what was your go-to sport?
Soccer, actually. The soccer, yeah, fields across the road, so it was easy for mum and dad. But I always thought I would have been a better league or union player, but I probably took it up too late.
Yeah.
And I was a bit soft. I wasn't keen on the tackling the big boys. So I was all right, touch footy and stuff like that. But it was, yeah, just if one regret, I would have started playing league a bit earlier and learnt to tackle properly and all that sort of stuff. But I like all sports. I really do love all the sports that Australia plays, especially. So, yeah, rugby union, I've probably in the last 10 or so years, especially in my time when I was in Wales, where like such a big rugby culture, got into that. Anytime the Wallabies play, I get a bit frustrated when they lose. So been some lean years, but hopefully they're going to turn things around.
So we've been chatting for 10 minutes. You've hardly mentioned cricket.
Yeah. It's funny. I am absolutely mad on cricket. But yeah, like at times you sort of need to get away. And I think that's the one thing I learned is, and that's hopefully what we get through the players. It's such a great game, but it can consume you. And so it's really important to have other outlets.
Do you think it consumes you more than other sports can?
Yeah, I do. I think that just the time involved. Think of, it's not so much bad in our game, but you know, the test matches and stuff like that. Like, you could be playing for 4 days, you could be playing for 5 days. You know, trying to plan in and around it, it's mentally quite exhausting, I think. We're pretty lucky, only playing 1 days in T20s. And so even training around that is a lot more concise, and I suppose you can get in and get out a little bit easier. But yeah, no, I absolutely love cricket. I've really, especially the last couple of years, where our team's got to, it's an absolute joy to turn up to work and just work with people who are so passionate and driven to be the best they can be.
Not too many people get that opportunity, do they, in a work sense?
No, and I suppose it's the same for you. It's like, it never really feels like work. It's hard being away from family. That's probably the hardest thing about the job, especially the young kids. You know, saying goodbye to my 11-year-old son now, who can't understand why I've got to go away for 6 or 7 weeks. That's hard. But look, they get into a routine when I'm away. I get into a routine, and thank God for Skype and, you know, FaceTime and stuff like that. I really think it'd be a struggle without that, not being able to see them. Yeah, it's funny, at the start of the tour, they're full attention and all that. By the end, they hardly give you a look in. So for Taryn and I, though, it's very, very good. We spent a lot of time apart, and we both live pretty good independent lives outside of that. But when we get back together, it's fantastic as well.
Do you think that's one of the biggest differences and changes between the men's and the women's side? Your wife, Taryn, works with Cricket Australia and helps deal with the men's side of things, and is in and around the fact that the organisation of family time around a massive content of cricket.
Yeah.
It's now getting more and more like that for the Australian women's team now, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean,
when you first started, was that 2015 as the coach? There was probably, you know, there might be a World Cup in a year, and then you'd sort of float around the Australian summer watching domestic cricket, and there might be one other tour kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's ramped up massively, hasn't it?
It has. And it'll be really interesting, because we're still waiting on the next Future Tours program from the ICC, but it went from, I used to work it out, it was around about 110 days camps and playing away. So I counted.
Would you be training more than playing?
Back then we were, yeah. We had a lot of big camps at the NCC in Brisbane. But now they're a lot smaller camps. We get in and get out and get things done. And also just how well the states have been doing with their resourcing now. We can actually let them be in their hometowns when they're home. And we know they're going to turn up in really good condition and be ready to go. So, but last year, I think it was 210 days I worked out that was not in my own bed. So that's quite a significant jump. And and then you see someone like Justin Langer, who's probably away 310 days. So
yeah,
it's a tough one on families. That's the hardest part of the job. But we love doing it, and we've got very understanding wives that, you know, allow us to try and make those sort of dreams happen, I guess.
Yeah. When you first transitioned into coaching, was that something that you were mindful of? Because you've come out of playing where you spend, you know, a fair chunk of the summer away.
Yeah.
And then you go into a job where you could be picked up anyway. When you're trying to get your foot in the door too, you're probably going to take any kind of opportunity you possibly can.
Yeah, it's a good question. I sort of fell into it a lot quicker than I thought I was going to. I guess in the back of my mind, I always thought that coaching or teaching would be where I'd end up. My brother was a phys ed teacher, and unfortunately didn't get the marks to get into phys ed. It was quite highly ranked.
Join the club, don't worry, it took me a while too.
Yeah. But I'd end up studying teaching, but not phys ed, which was higher. And so I always loved education. Mum and dad, both teachers, other sister was a teacher. So it's sort of in the blood. And I did my level one when I was 16, I think. I did have an appetite for coaching. The guy who was Dave Gilbert, who you'd know, who ended up CEO. And that's sort of how it all, it's funny, sliding doors moments. Went and did my level one with him. And then I was sort of washing up my cricket career with Victoria and thinking of heading back to Queensland and maybe taking up a development officer's type role in Queensland. And literally a sliding door moment was that. Ended up at AB medal that year because someone pulled out at late notice. Ran into Dave and Christina Matthews, who was then the marketing manager. Mm-hmm. And they were asking what I was going to do. And I said, I think I'll head back to Queensland. And then about 3 weeks later, obviously a seed was sown that night. Dave Gilbert rang me out of nowhere and said, we're thinking of this position as a player coach in our second 11, similar to what they used to do in England, where you weren't really a prominent player, but you sat there and helped guide the captain and the younger players. And he said, would you be interested? I said, I'll be there tomorrow. And then I went back to Victoria and told them that I was going to finish up. And Sean Graff at the time sort of made a counter offer, but I actually thought I probably need to get away from the playing group that I've just played with. Yeah. And so it was definitely a move. It was out of my comfort zone into Sydney, but it was probably the best move I've made.
You mentioned not coaching players that you've just played with.
Yep.
I'm hopefully going to grab a corner, Lisa Kightley, at some stage. She went through that same sort of period as coming out of the game and then coaching the Australian women's cricket team straight away, but it was still quite a crossover with, you know, coaching players that she'd played with.
Yeah.
Do you think coaches need that sort of time away?
I do, and it would be interesting to see what Lisa says, but she privately she said the same to me. She didn't think that she was quite ready for that role when she first took it over, and I think that's why she probably ended up going to England and getting over there and coaching in their system, and then she's back. She's been a bit of a boomerang, hasn't she? She's back and forth. But no, I'm really happy for her. I think she's a lovely person. I've known her for a long time from Cricket New South Wales days, and she's exactly what they need. I think she'll be really good for them. She knows how to play the game. She's done some great things in Perth, and I think she knows their system well. So it's not just chucking an Aussie into an English system. She actually knows their system, knows their younger players well. So they're going to be a formidable force under her leadership for sure.
What's your biggest strength as a coach?
I think I've got a lot of empathy. I think I can, being a bit of a battler as a player myself, I can see when people are struggling and I can, you know, try and get down to their level and talk to them about some strategies to be better. But I think I just like people. I think it's probably the biggest thing that I just like helping. I like helping people and I like seeing people get better. And it's always been part of how I roll. And probably looking back on reflection, it probably got me into a few teams that, you know, maybe statistically I didn't deserve to be in at times because I just like seeing others get better. And I think that's what we've tried to do, certainly as a team. We've got some fantastic support staff that have come in the last couple of years, and even those before that just built a really strong foundation. And our players often remark how they just love being back around our group. And to me, in elite sport, if you can get that where people enjoy hanging around each other, that's the gold standard, isn't it? And when people turn up and they want to make it a better place, when you've got talent, that's really exciting.
Is that one of the biggest strengths of the Australian women's cricket team at the moment? I mean, I think a lot of people sort of look at the program here in Australia and are quite envious, I guess, and that's because of an investment and a vision that started quite a long way back. Mm. But you look at the Australian team now, they're on record runs, they're winning World Cups, they're probably one of the most recognised brands in Australian sport at the moment as well, which in a lot of other countries would be, you know, very, very envious of.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to 2017 because it's, for an outsider looking in, it seems like one of the pivotal points when you guys lost the semi-final of the World Cup to India. And there was a lot of chat about some, you know, going away and having a meeting, and there's some sort of honesty session and pretty hard session at that. Yep. Was that a turning point, do you think, for the team?
Undoubtedly, yeah. In my whole playing and coaching, I don't think there's been a bigger change that I've seen in a team. So just to wind back, we got knocked out, and as most things, like, you're preparing to play in a final. We had our head around, you know, we're going to be in the final. We fully expected to be there. We knew India were a very good team. We certainly didn't underestimate them. But in our own minds, like, this is our time. And we'd seen some cracks for a while. We were playing quite conservatively, and so we were relying on our pure talent for a long time. And there's a couple of instances in the lead up where Adepadu took us down, beautiful 100. But that was sort of one of the signs as well. We just didn't react really well to it at all. Yeah. And as a team, we'd spoken about it quite a bit. Like, we can't just keep relying on our talent to get us over the line, which it did in that match.
Yeah.
And we knew it was coming. We knew there was just going to be someone who just took the game on and took it away from us. And it wasn't until that happened that a penny dropped with everyone.
You needed that loss for
us. We sort of did, and I hate to say that. And yeah, it was probably in my time. I don't think I've ever been more devastated by a loss. You know, it was gut-wrenching because we'd been playing okay, and we thought we were a good chance of winning that. And it was like a mad hour. And, it, you know, when you talk about teams, and everything just seemed in fast motion. And you could see that on the player's face. You look back, like, they were rabbit in the headlights. And they all admitted that. And it wasn't until, you know, even the break, so we run off in the break, and they're trying to, and I remember speaking to Pete, our sports psych, Peter Clark, and I said, "Mate, what did you think?" Because he's good at critically analysing what we're doing. He said, "Mate, you couldn't have done much more." And trying to slow everyone down, said, "Right, that didn't end well. Let's just get back on track."
Yeah.
But it was madness. And we had to get back out there in 7 minutes of bat.
Yeah.
Because it was overtime and stuff. So it was a great learning curve for everyone, coaches, players alike. And we got back. So everyone's scarpered at the end of that tournament because we didn't plan for that. So we didn't really get a chance to debrief it. And it was about 4 months later we met up for planning for the Ashes in Australia. And Pete and I sat down and we deliberated over this for hours trying to work out what was the best strategy. We knew we had to put that to bed and then prepare for the Ashes. And we tried to get our head around it. We eventually came up with this theory that we played Harmanpreet Kaur's innings with no sound, no nothing, in the darkness in the room of the NCC, and we just played it.
Yeah. And then, well, I'm glad you didn't listen to the commentary.
No, I don't think I'll ever want to listen to that. So we sat there in that room and we watched her whole innings.
Yeah.
And then we didn't say a thing. We just put chairs around the circle. And one by one, the players just unloaded. You know, Meg Lanning said she hadn't really slept because she was so embarrassed about the performance. Jess Johnson went and spoke about how she felt and all that sort of stuff. And it was just so emotional. You know, it was really emotional. But it was the best thing that we've ever done. You know, everyone poured out their emotions. And we left it that day, like, we let that happen, and then we said, right, tomorrow we come back and we're playing for the Ashes. And
so I'm going to take you back to the game itself then, after the game when everyone was in the change rooms. Did you think that you'd get to this point, or, like, what was the reaction in the change rooms itself?
It was pure disbelief, I think. Yeah, I think in tournament play, people understand that it's a pretty fickle game. But even, like, we were probably more vulnerable in T20 at that stage than we were in one-day cricket, even though I think in our T20 record at that stage was hot and cold.
Yeah.
Our one-day strategy was pretty good. And over a period of time, we'd always feel like we could get back into matches.
Yeah. But
so we certainly weren't planning to be knocked out. In the rooms after, it was just disbelief. And credit to everyone. Like, we did then all catch up at the hotel later and made sure that we all stood together and but there was not a lot of cricket chat, and it was like trying to like almost forget it straight away.
Mm.
So that grieving, it didn't happen until, you know, as a group, until that NCC meeting. And we've just got so much better. I mean, someone like Rachel Haynes has come in to our team, made such a difference about how we speak in our meetings before and after, and how accountable we are to be really honest in those meetings.
Yeah.
And she's got a great fluff radar. If someone's talking fluff and, you know, trying to dilly-dally around things, she'll call it. And that's been infectious in our team now. So when we have our team meetings, we can quite honestly dissect the game without, you know, worrying about treading on toes. And that wasn't part of how we're operating at that stage. Everyone was a little bit, if I say this, someone will get upset.
Yep.
So, and it's just, I think, because it was almost like we hit that rock bottom. It's like, if we keep doing the same things here, we're just going to keep getting the same results. So, yeah, I credit Rachel. And even things like Meg Lanning spending time out of the team. I think you know yourself that everyone, basically the perception was if Meg or Pez didn't get runs, we couldn't win. And rightly or wrongly, that's what people thought. And so her out of that team, and then other players took an opportunity to step up. Your Boltons, your Moonies, those sort of players that really stepped up and did extremely well. So, and Rach herself, you know, she took on a lot of leadership. She got confidence in the group.
Yeah.
And the best thing about Rachel, I guess, is that she's happy to be the vice captain as well. Like, she doesn't need to be captain to lead. And I think that's a really strong part of our group.
Before we get onto the World Cup, is there a standout moment where you've been the proudest as a coach? And I don't think that has to be winning Ashes or World Cups. Yeah. Is there a moment we just stood back and thought, yeah, we're there, this is...
I think it's pretty easy, but that World Cup in the West Indies for me, that was the most, you know, talk about teams. We'd been good for a long time, but we hadn't had anything to show for it. Like, we'd won Ashes and stuff like that, but just to be able to sit back, watch that group of... pardon me, players and staff, and we sat on the pitch there afterwards, and you know, that's the happiest I've been, like, in terms of pure relief, because there was an expectation at that stage for us to win, but then trying to combat that relief and actually just sit back and enjoy it, and it was a real, I guess, conscious effort to make sure really enjoyed it, because it had been a tough road. You know, we'd had our, when you're expected to win a lot, the losses, you know, take their toll.
Yeah.
So I was just relieved. Meg especially, you know, she'd been captain for a long time, one of the greatest players in the history, but, you know, hadn't won it as captain. So just her, you know, she's not an emotional person at all, but her reaction, you know, the way she grabbed Ash at the end, like, that's just, you don't see that too often. So that's how much it meant to us. Been a long time without a World Cup for a good team. So, yeah, I think that was certainly the time. But I think the whole... since 2017, just the way that the players in particular have just been really honest with each other and accountable for their actions. And I think the group pretty much self-governs now. And as a coach, you know, we're a very lucky coaching staff. We can actually coach rather than having to manage. And that's, you know, in a lot of teams, a lot of your time is spent managing behaviours. But this group, they manage themselves, you know. It's very rare. Like, if anything, we just have to slow them down and make sure they don't work too hard. That's the biggest thing is worrying about burnout, because they're so driven.
I'm going to give you time to finish your coffee. We're going to take a quick break here. And we're going to come back. We're going to chat about expectations, because I think that's probably one of the key drivers to winning a World Cup at home.
On SEN, this is Road to the T20 World Cup with Mel Jones.
Does the word expectation scare you a little bit? Do you get nervous about a home World Cup?
No, not really. I think I don't want to steal the thunder, but we're all catching up on the 15th. And one of the main themes, I think, is, and I spoke briefly to Michael Lloyd the other day about the men's when they prepared for 2015. And they just went out and said, let's go out and grab it and have a good time. And I think it's been such a long time since we've had a World Cup. You can look at it as a millstone around your neck, or you're just a great opportunity to play in front of your home fans and friends. And that's going to be our messaging, basically. And expectation is a good thing. Like, it means you're going pretty well as a team if people are expecting you to win. And we all also smart enough to know, we found out the hard way, that tournament play is very different. You know, if we're playing a bilateral series against teams, you can have a bad hour or you know, a bad game and get back into the series.
Yeah.
So, and especially T20. We know how hard it was to win the last one in the West Indies, and how many things just went our way at the right time, and we won some critical moments. So we're certainly under no illusion that it's going to be hard work. But it's almost like, let's embrace it. If people want to call us favourites, that's fine.
Yep.
Once the first ball's bowled, that goes out the window anyway. We start on the same points as everyone else.
Yeah.
There's great teams out there. You know, England, I think South Africa, just looking at their players in the WBBL this year, are going to be a real force. India, we know, are incredibly dangerous, and we play them in the first game. So it's going to be an unbelievable World Cup. Obviously, we'd love to be there at the MCG on that final day, International Women's Day, and that's something that will certainly burn for everyone. But there's just so much cricket before then that we need to win and do well in before we get that opportunity.
Before, you mentioned you're a coach now that is actually coaching and not managing. Do you feel as if that might sort of sway back a little bit for this tournament? Because the hype is it's building now. Once the sort of the test series for the men is done and dusted and Big Bash is done, it'll really build up. The fact that they've revamped the old "Come on Aussie, come on" song and all those sorts of things, that particularly maybe for the younger players within the squad, that I know the squad's not picked yet, but there will be a lot of management around that, won't it?
Yeah, there will, but we've got some great staff who do that. I mentioned before Peter Clark, who's a sports psych, and we're going to make sure that we really prioritise what's important and make sure that players, we have a no surprises policy. So all that stuff around media, we try and communicate that as early as we can.
Yeah.
And we're going to accept that there's going to be greater demand. It is a short tournament. It's pretty much in and out. So yeah, the players have now, and which is absolutely critical, had 3 weeks off around Christmas. So they're recharged, ready to go. When we get back together on the 15th, we'll start really fine-tuning our planning, make sure our roles are really clear. And so just concentrate on what's in front of us. Like it's a cliche, but the process is more important. So if we get all our ducks in a row and make sure that we're switched on and the white noise is what it is, it's in the background, embrace it, though. I think it's really important that we don't shy away from it.
Yeah.
The results will take care of themselves. We, you know, whoever wins this World Cup will have played a lot of great cricket. They've probably had a bit of luck along the way. So hopefully that luck falls our way. We'll be doing everything we can. It's the same. I think you talk about getting the monkey off the back, but the last World Cup was like a gorilla off the back. So I actually do think that we'll go in. I think we went into the last World Cup hoping we'd win it and not make mistakes. I hope we go into this World Cup going, let's go out and really take this on. We talk about fearless in our culture. So this is an opportunity to really live and breathe that and take it on. What an opportunity to, you know, potentially play in such a huge crowd. And that's the carrot at the end. But we first game's India, and we need to get over them.
When did preparation for this T20 World Cup start for you?
Oh, it's been going on for the best part of all since the last World Cup, really. Yeah. You know, we've watched a lot of WBBL. Selectors are chatting all the time about what we need. We've got some great people at Cricket Australia doing work on venues and matchups, right, real deep stuff in terms of, you know, combining WBBL numbers with international numbers. So there's a huge amount of work that's gone on behind the scenes. But that's all the sort of the stuff that the players won't see. And then when we get back to them, we just try and present a real clear and concise plan about how we're going to play in it. It won't change a lot from what we've been doing. I think certainly our T20 cricket has got a lot better over the last couple of years. I think I said to you before that we were probably at 60-40 a few years ago in terms of win rate. That wasn't really where we should be. And I think we've improved out of sight in that area. And we've obviously had a good run. But say it again, fickle game T20. So
it is.
You need to start the tournament well and then grip on and get to those semis, and then anyone's a chance.
Style of play has been something as a commentator and a fan, and you know, being involved in it all and watching the way in which the Australian women's cricket team go about their T20 game. Style of play has seemed to shift it, and I think it's been an advantage to other teams too, because I think they always look towards Australia as to, you know, where's the next step and improving standards. The style of play in terms of just taking the game on, particularly in the power play and then that sort of top 4 to 5 players. Is that something that you really focused on to say, okay, the game's here at the moment, we're here at the moment, we've got a chance to just really blow it all open?
Yeah, a great question. I think it definitely, there was a seismic shift in the way we played, and that came out of that 2017 World Cup as well. But we ran numbers, and like we were, as I said, not winning as many games as we should have. But the key thing from our batting point of view was we were still only losing 4 or 5 wickets. And when you looked at our batting lineup, we had 8 people that opened their batting in their franchises in WBBL. So that's just a waste of resources. So we actually looked at it quite differently and said, rather than worrying too much about how many wickets we lose in the power play, let's just maximise the power play, take it on. If we lose 3, we've got enough batting to cover. And even things like people from the outside a bit critical about someone like Elise Perry batting the middle order. But it was all about the strategy of let's get our highest strikers in as early as we can, take advantage. If they get out, it's not such a bad thing. We know we've got Meg, Elise, Rachel Haynes in the middle order who can sum up the game really well, say we need to put the foot on and keep going, or we just need to rebuild a little bit here. So it was more about better utilising the resources that we had and maximising how many batters we used. It doesn't make sense to only lose 3 or 4 wickets when you've got such batting depth. And it's interesting,
then you see some of the WBBL teams that have tried it but perhaps don't have that depth.
Yeah.
You can't go with as much confidence because you need to know that there's some really good batters behind mm-hmm. you. And yeah. I think that's when we finally embrace that.
Is it a hard sell? Because for the top order, yeah. this is their careers and everything to start with too. So if it doesn't come off,
yeah.
they're thinking, well, sheesh, am I going to still get picked?
It actually wasn't a hard sell. And that, I go back to the having strong leaders in the group, Megan and Rach in particular. We sat down with each player and went through their roles. And it was in the first time we really tried it was the Tri Series in India. And we got some of our best scores by 40 or 50 runs over. And it was great batting conditions.
Yeah.
But it was like, this is the way we want to play. Are you comfortable with the role? And there was, it was able to debate and talk about how you could see your role change. But across the board, everyone's like, yep, I'll do that. If that's the best for the team, you want me to bat there, I can bat there, I can do that role. And so, just the way, I think it's not, you can't just come out and go, this is the way we're going to play, you're going to do this and that. Yeah. So it was about investing time and explaining the rationale behind it. And then once we got that and it had immediate success, people were like, yep, I'm in this.
Yeah.
And some of the things that we've been trying for a couple of years, I don't think statistically T20 is well represented in terms of a player's value. So we have our own internal system where it's player impact rating.
Okay.
So we value a lot, like players coming in at 6 and perhaps getting 13 off 7 balls.
Yeah.
But that's a great effort in their role. They've only got 7 opportunities and they've scored 13. So mm-hmm. we'll actually rank that quite high in our ranking, as opposed to an opener who gets to bat at the top, gets to face the new ball and might score a run a ball, whereas the impact from that 7 balls might be a lot greater.
Yeah.
So we, in our debriefs, we try and recognise those moments. It's the same with the ball. So inevitably there's a short boundary or a crappy end into the wind or whatever.
Yeah.
So the person who only goes for 7 off that over when they're doing the hard yards in the wind, we'll recognise that in our debriefs.
So it's quite subjective though.
It is. We have a ranking each over. So each coach does a win or loss for the overs, for instance, for the bowlers. And then that's accumulated over time. Wickets obviously important, so that goes into the mix as well. And then economy rates go into it. And then we'll come up with a leading bowler for the day and a leading batter. But it won't necessarily just be the one who's taking the most wickets because you might get 2 in the last over, they're donging it up in the air, as opposed to real impact, knock over their top. So it is subjective, but what it does is it recognises the non-traditional things that we measure in T20. And strike rates for batting is really important. And winning overs for your team in T20, because that's all about partnership bowling. Giving a single away on the last ball or something on purpose so that you're bowling the other person's bowling the right batter. All those sort of things go into it. So you're sort of utilising the intel of all our coaches and having some measurements around it.
Do you get frustrated that, and it's the T20 game and I get the whole, sixes and fours and batters and runs and all those sorts of things, but the Australian bowling unit has been so impressive for such a long time and it feels as if sometimes they're undervalued or underrated for what they've actually produced?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's changed. And I think you look at someone like Megan Shute, who's been incredible, and her evolution is quite staggering, I think. Like, she's always been a very talented bowler, but she had a year or two there where she was just sliding away a bit, and she took a lot of critical feedback on board and come back really well. She's had number of problems with her knees and stuff like that, and her training work ethic is incredible. And someone like Jess Johnson, similar sort of things, injuries. But I really think it's been a great evolution of our bowling coaches that have come there. Joey Dawes did some fantastic work originally with our bowling group, and once he moved on, Ash Nofke came in and had a really good impact in India.
Yeah,
and he was big on changes of pace.
And he's impacted the Brisbane Heat with
their and then Ben Sawyer now has inherited a team that's very good, and he's taken them to another level again. So we've been really fortunate around the bowling group, and Shelley Nitschke with the spinners. She's so well respected. She's quiet, Shell, but everyone knows, what she needs to do. And she's really good one-on-one with the bowlers. She'll take them out for coffee and take the spinners out. So they absolutely adore her. So we've got a really good mix, and we've been very lucky. Tim Coyle, early days with our fielding, really set the tone with that. So, we're very lucky to, I think, some of the coaches that we've had around this group in the last few years. But the bowling group in particular, talk about 2017, where we didn't have a plan B, we were only playing A, and when we were under fire, we just looked around and went, who's going to help us here?
Yeah.
To now, we've been got a number of times, but our reaction to how we've been got is so much better. I mean, I think
in the last series against Sri Lanka when Adepadu got that 100 at North Sydney. A lot of people were going, oh, here we go again. But coaching-wise, we sat back and went, no, they're actually making the right decisions here. She's just playing a fabulous inning.
Yeah.
And she was hitting balls where we were going to a wider plan, for example, out of the ground. Mm. But we wouldn't have even tried that wider plan. We would have just kept serving it up. So the willingness to be fearless with the ball has improved, and you know, the changes of pace have been the big part of that. And we're bowling a lot more bumpers now as well, which will please a lot of people. But someone like Taylor Blamink coming in, and I think I was in commentary with you guys in Brisbane this year, and seeing her steam into Beth Mooney in that game there, and you know, getting her jumping around, I think that was probably one of my favourite moments of the season. And that's where we want the game to go as well. We want exciting young quicks coming into the game. Yeah. And getting the pick of some of the best athletes going around in the next couple of years is really important to that.
I know we've chatted about this before, but the top end for the women's game in terms of pace bowling, so the Lia Tahuhu and your Taylor, as you just mentioned then, sort of around that, you know, 125, sort of pushing that. Can we sort of get a crop of bowlers across all nations in every team where there's, you know, there's probably, you know, one or two bowling about that 130k? And is it important?
Yeah, I think it is important. I really do. I think, you know, generally when people come and have a look at the game, inevitably they're going to compare it to men's cricket often. Mm-hmm. And the feedback I get is that the batting is incredible. Like, it's amazing how close the batters are. But the overwhelming thing is the pace, and people talk about it. And like, I don't think it's the be-all and end-all. I personally, from a coaching point of view, I think trajectory and bounce is going to be more of a player. So getting tall bowlers that can hit a length and hit the top, like a Goswami, for example, from India, I think in the short term that's going to be really achievable. And whether or not, the other side of it is short-term pain, because they go for a lot more runs in our game, the fast bowlers. Mm-hmm. Spin's very effective, take the pace off, you can only get hit to certain areas. Whereas our batters don't mind the extra pace on it. You know, we see Lia Tahuhu come in the bowl, and you know it's either going to be feast or famine. You know, like she's going to either knock a couple over, or you know, it's a really good run scoring opportunity. Yeah. So that's where coaches and captains need to persevere and think of the long term, and you know, keep rewarding players who want to come in and bowl quick. But I do, to your point, I do think it's coming. Mm. I think there's some, as I said, once you start really getting the pick of the crop, and then in terms of athletes coming through that have got the engine to bowl quick, it's just a matter of getting our coaching and strength and conditioning right, and it's there. But I think realistically 130 is going to be around the limit. I think there's not going to be too many who are going to bowl much quicker than that, and I don't think you need to bowl much quicker than that.
There's the challenge out there for everyone. We're looking for a couple of 130s just to prove Modding wrong. Maybe 135, bring it on.
You reckon 135?
No,
I'd love to see that.
Wouldn't we just? Okay, a couple of quick ones to finish up with, because I know we've got to go to Kirribilli House and meet the Prime Minister. Right, how life changes. Alrighty, if you, of all the players in the international game at the moment that you wouldn't mind having a coaching session with outside of Australia, who would it be?
That I could coach?
Yeah, you'd have a little session with.
I'm a huge Sophie Devine fan, as a lot of people are. And I actually, I think there's some parts of her game which I could help with as well. Yeah. So, like, I just see a huge talent, but I do. Yeah, there's some parts of her game that I reckon that if she unlocked, probably just more her consistency, I reckon.
With the bat or the ball?
With both. I watch her bowl, and she's one of those bowls that rips in and does that, probably tries a little bit too much at times, and you just like doesn't back her stock ball, which is very dangerous outswinger.
Yeah.
And batting wise, just some work against spin. I think she can knock anyone out of the park, and when she's set, but just probably starting the game. So she'd be one. I don't know. Amelia Kerr to me is a huge talent as well. Yeah. So probably going to the Kiwis, but looking at her bowl, I remember her bowling at Mount Maunganui a couple of years ago against Meg. Mm-hmm. Meg made 100. I don't think she's ever had to work harder for 100. I think Kerr bowled 8 overs straight at it. I don't remember bowling a bad ball. It was a mixture of wrong-ins and great leggies in there.
As a teenage leg spinner.
And she can obviously bat as well. Mm. I mean, her innings at the NCC this year when she whacked 4 fours through covers in an over to win them that game. So, those two probably standouts. Yeah, obviously I'll get to see a few in the 100 this year there with the Welsh Fire. So that'll be interesting. And, that's a really exciting competition. I know you and I have spoken a bit about women's IPL, but to me that's just another one that's going to be great globally for the game. And certainly for our players, it comes at a really good time in the off season to get us up and about and get ready for that one day World Cup coming up in New Zealand.
Time frame on a female coach of a Big Bash team, men's Big Bash.
It's already happened, hasn't it? Pricey team.
Head coach.
Look, I think Shell was a trailblazer a few years ago. She obviously got in the men's pathway. I don't think it's far away. I don't see why not, and quickly. Shell in our setup is a great coach. And to me, it's just about those coaches wanting to risk it for the biscuit, as Meg always says. Do you want to go out there and go that way? We've always spoken, and Ben Oliver, I know, is big on it as well, is that we should be able to seamlessly go from one to another. I've done work with the men's team. There's no reason why we can't get those opportunities. And then it's just about developing rapport with players, and inevitably they will pump you up and say you're a good coach or you're not a good coach. So whether you're male or female, it shouldn't make any difference at all. I think some of the best critical analysis people in the game are females, and they're really leading the way. And it wasn't that long ago that you couldn't see a female in the commentary box, and now you don't even notice that, male or female. It's just critiquing the game for what it is. And coaching is about developing relationships with players and staff and trying to get the best out of them. So I can't think of why it's such a big issue.
91,000 at the MCG, March 8, International Women's Day. Katy Perry, I don't know if you know her songs, so you're ready to sing or not, but what would it mean to you?
It'd be huge. I don't think you could possibly think of a much more important day for sport, I think, in this country, not just female sport, but it is as global as you're going to get. As you said, 90,000. It's an amazing carrot for our group to get to, but whoever the two teams are there, they will be pioneers. There's never going to be a bigger match, in the history of women's cricket, if you can play the MCG in front of a... Even if you got 60,000 there.
Yeah, if you fall short, it's still going to be chockers.
Talking about expectation, we need to manage that expectation. Yeah. But I don't think they could be doing too much more. I've been driving around the streets, there's posters of our players everywhere. Nick Hockley and his team have really gone out and they've been ambitious. And when we first heard about it, we're like, wow, you really think you can do that? And then things like Katy Perry pop up and, even you'd expect her to be able to drag 30,000 in. So those sort of things. It's International Women's Day. Like, all the cards are falling into favour. Yeah. We've got to play our part, obviously, and try and get there. Mm-hmm. We're more than aware that it's going to be bloody hard work, but it's exciting to think of what that could be. It's an amazing the way, even to just go stand alone for that World Cup in Australia initially, and then to put it on the scale it's been. Certainly, you can't say they haven't had a crack. Everyone that's been involved so far has really put it up there. Hopefully, they get their just rewards, and we do as well.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. And I almost got through the entire time without showing my bias there. Moddy, really appreciate it. You've always been so open to chatting all things Australian women's cricket, but just cricket in general. I do wish you all the best for the World Cup.
Thanks, Heath.
And he is hoping that on International Women's Day, where everyone is smiling.
Goosebumps, then.
There you go. Perfect way to finish things.
Cheers, Mel. Thanks.